Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes in London, and this is The Unexplained. That shocked you, didn't it? Just a little variation from the usual words that I use. You know, I always like to use the same words at the beginning of the podcast because I think it creates a kind of comfort and familiarity. And I used to love to hear Art Bell back in the day say, "From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you good evening." I kind of felt safe and comfortable when I knew that Art was there. All those miles away in the high desert, all the, you know, thousands of miles away from London, it just gave me a sense of comfort. So that's why I do it, really. I just wanted to change it there to see if you noticed. But there you are. I've given the game away myself. Thank you for all of your emails. Keep them coming. Go to the website, theunexplained.tv. You can send me an email from there. And when you get in touch, tell me who you are. Please use your name, where you are, and how you use this show. Website created by Adam. Thank you to Haley for booking the guests, including the ones that we're about to speak with now. This, I think, is going to be a different and special show. Three people who are a kind of Rat Pack, or Bee Gees, or another three-person group of the ufological and paranormal worlds. The people we're about to speak with, two of whom we've spoken with before, Darcy Weir, Canadian investigator and filmmaker, Stephen Bassett, of course, old friend of mine and this show, leading disclosure campaigner from the Paradigm Research Group, and Gary King, captivated by crop circles since the 1990s. We're going to cover an astonishing amount of ground, I think, in the next hour or so, including a ufological mystery, underground bases, crop circles, and abductions, if we're lucky to fit all of that in this time, with an interesting combination of people. I hope technically this is going to work, and thanks to Michelle for setting all of this up. Gentlemen, in your three locations, thank you for coming on The Unexplained. We have Darcy Weir in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, Steve Bassett in the good old United States of America, and in the land of the Aztecs and various other phenomena too, Mexico, we have Gary King. The three of you, thank you very much for coming on The Unexplained together.
Hey, Howard. Really happy to be here, of course, again, and happy to be with my mates.
Howard, I'm still in Washington, as long as it's still here.
Well, no, I mean, that is something that, you know, we're certainly hoping persists, Steve, for a whole variety of reasons, including those hearings that we hope happen there about UFOs. Mm. That's another topic. And, of course, Gary, welcome.
Absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks very much, Howard.
Now, this is a complex technical arrangement that we've got. Four people, four different locations across the globe, but I'm confident that we're going to make this happen. It is also going to be a complex discussion, which will encompass, I believe, three documentaries, three sets of research, but all of them connected. Darcy, maybe you can lead me into this.
Sure. I guess we'll start from The Underground, which really is about military-industrial complex involvement with building underground bases since post-World War II, and what these bases might be used for, which would include clandestine sort of exotic research, technologies that should be kept out of sight, out of sound. I created a documentary called The Underground back in I started it in the year 2000, and I published a version of it in 2012, and then it was re-remastered and released in 2020 as a director's cut with some extra information. And we cover government secrecy in it, UFOs, the story of Phil Schneider, and the most important sort of underground bases. And when people hear the title The Underground, they tend to be attracted to this storyline because of the idea that UFOs, for example, and the story of extraterrestrial intelligence possibly interfacing with Earth throughout history has really been a story that's been forced underground. You know, it's been kept secret. And this relates to the type of work that Stephen Bassett's been doing for over 25 years in terms of trying to end the truth embargo, get the government to officially admit through the president that we're not alone and that UFOs are probably being operated by extraterrestrial visitors to our planet. Gary King, I've worked with him recently on a documentary called Crop Circle Realities. And we talk about the history of crop circles and the interesting messages that have been laid out, and that at least 20% of all crop circle phenomenon must not be man-made. So these are crops that show glyphs, that show signals or messages that we do not think are created by man.
All right, and let's bring Gary in here while we're on that subject, and then we will get back to the underground bases.
Sure.
That's the way I think it's probably going to work. But let me just ask you one quick question, Gary, in Mexico, about the crop circle thing. You obviously monitor crop circles as they appear around the world, and they are an international phenomenon. One thing that struck me as interesting in the United Kingdom in the period of lockdown, which has stretched over most of the last year here in the UK, and, you know, it seems it's going to stretch a little further, there have still been complex formations of crop circles reported in the UK. Now, if everybody's locked down and people claim that they are created by human beings, that does not compute. What do you say?
Well, yes, this has happened before. I don't know if you remember back in 2000 or 2001 when we had the foot and mouth problem. There was a massive embargo on people going out into the fields, and there were, you know, there were all sorts of restrictions. And yet, if you look at the how many crop circles appeared in the UK at that time, there were, you know, I'm not sure the exact figure, but there are upwards of 100 formations. And so, it doesn't matter whether there are any restrictions, and this lockdown has been the most heaviest of restrictions, the crop circles continue to appear.
And so, do you believe, as that certain fact would suggest, that here is proof that if people are having to stay indoors and they're not allowed to associate with other people if they're obeying the rules, then there would at least be a significant diminution in the number of human-made crop circles appearing, and that really hasn't happened. So something else, if you extrapolate from that fact, must be happening. And the something else is that someone else from somewhere else is creating these things.
Yes, I would go along with that. I think there are a number of factors which indicate that these are not all man-made. And I've mentioned this many times in lectures I've given around the world and various TV interviews and so on, that there are a number of factors which really do discredit the man-made theory. And one of those is when we have a serious lockdown, we've either got the conclusion that people are just breaking and ignoring that and going out in the fields as they say they are, or it's coming from another source.
And, you know, if it was people breaking the rules, then they'd have to be doing it in some numbers. And it would be inevitable, and I watch the newspapers and their websites like a hawk, that some of those people creating those crop circles against lockdown regulations in the UK would find themselves on the receiving end of action from the police. And as far as I'm aware, nobody's been arrested for being out of their homes at times when you shouldn't be, in places where you shouldn't be, creating crop circles against the lockdown regs. So there is another factor. Okay, last question, and we'll come back to the crop circles a little later, Gary. Are the nature of the designs, some of which are incredibly geometrically complex, are they changing, or is it always the same sorts of things that appear?
They give us various... So the geometric aspect, it forms one category. There are five categories of crop circles, and the geometry is the main one. Geometry is something that was used by the ancient Greeks as a form of philosophy and cosmology. It was a tool used to understand the unfolding of material reality and how flowers take fivefold forms in nature and the Fibonacci sequence is present in the human body and in nature and so on and so forth. And so it was all used as a tool to understand whether or not the universe was intelligently designed and therefore what was our place as human beings in the universe. And so there were various geometric constructions that were made by the Greeks and indeed people that have followed in their footsteps over the years, such as squaring the circle, pi, the Fibonacci sequence, as I mentioned, or the golden ratio, that have been incorporated into the designs of crop circles in very unique ways. In fact, the squaring of the circle, which is an ancient geometric puzzle, which basically means how to unite heaven and earth. It's the uniting of heaven and earth, the square being the symbol for earth and the circle being the symbol for heaven. Many geometer philosophers over the years have tried unsuccessfully to solve that puzzle, to make a square have the same perimeter or perimeter of the square and unite with the circumference of a circle, or indeed the areas of the square and the circle to be pretty much the same. And we can look back, this is something we can look back on over history and find, you know, what sort of solutions the ancient people came up with. And they got, let's say, 96, 97% accuracy with very, very complex geometric constructions in order to achieve that. What the crop circles have given us is 100 new ways to back engineer squared circles, which are accurate to the thickness of the pencil line. And they've done this in a very simple, simple way. In fact, I was able to teach my children how to do this when they were 8 and 9 years old. So when we look at an intelligence, in my view, a definition of high intelligence is when somebody can take something that's very complicated and make it very, very simple for everybody to understand. And that's what the crop circles have done for us.
Okay, there are some other questions I want to ask you about crop circles, but we'll leave that for a little while. Steve Bassett, you and I have never discussed crop circles. Do you think that they're important?
My favorite extraterrestrial phenomena, Howard. Love it. How can you not like crop circles? As you know, I'm a political activist, not a researcher, so everything that comes my way, I look at through the activist and the political perspective. So with crop circles, or agriglyphs, as I kind of prefer to call them, a little more comprehensive.
Love the word.
This is what comes to mind. The way the truth embargo works, one of the key aspects of the truth embargo that's successful is to make everybody, whoever, have to prove everything over and over and over. Once is not enough. You got to keep proving it over again. I call this the Cool Hand Luke gambit. A classic movie from the 60s starring Paul Newman. So he's in this prison in Louisiana, and he's going to be punished. So they make him go out in the hot sun and dig a ditch. And after he finishes the ditch, the boss man comes out and tells him to fill it back up. And he does that. And then they come back, and they say, dig it again. This goes on all day until he collapses in the ditch staring up at the stars. Crop circles were proven to be ET decades ago. Why? It's simple. Aside from the basic examinations that took place of the crops and so forth, showing clear anomalies and what have you, there were instances where people, oftentimes in flights, usually it was ultralights, were flying over the fields during crop circle season, where thousands came out to see if they could catch them doing it. And they would fly over a field and there was nothing there. And then they'd fly back 5-10 minutes later and there's a multi-acre crop circle. Mm. Case closed. Done. Finished. It's not necessary to prove one more damn thing about the ET reality of that. Humans cannot lay down multi-acre crop circles in 5 minutes.
But one of the things, Steve, about the film, yes, Cool Hand Luke, which is clearly one of your favorite films and is one of the films that I've probably watched most along with The Shawshank Redemption, in that same scene where he's got to dig the ditch and then fill it in again because the boss man tells him to, the boss says to him, I believe, at one point when he gives back chat, it may be a different scene, but I think it's this one, it says to him, what we got here is a failure to communicate. Now, that isn't that the case of crop circles, though? If somebody wants to communicate, this is a really difficult way to do this. Why don't they write a clear message, like get your act together on the lawn of Buckingham Palace?
What we have here is failure to communicate. That's a little That's more like good. It. That was a different scene. No, a nice segue. Very good. You're a pro, Howard. You really are. the ETs are communicating just well. Thank you. I think they've been around this track a few times. The fundamental communication is we're here. The second fundamental communication is the escalation of the circles, of the agroglyphs, in complexity and so forth and size over the decades. That's not an accident. I believe the communication from that is something is coming. Right. As far as messages within all of these complex grounds, there could be. There doesn't have to be. The very fact that they're complex just has drawn humans to them, spending endless hours trying to figure out if there's a message here, what does that diagram mean, and so forth. And then there are the humans that actually make crop circles. So the ultimate thing going on, almost all in the UK, for reasons that are not known, but we can speculate, is an engagement. They've simply drawn us into engaging them and the phenomena, and in a very nonviolent way. It's good, right?
All right. But if my message is not getting across, then I will tend, if I'm out and about, I will speak louder. Are the aliens or whoever creates these things speaking louder to us because we don't seem to be getting it?
I'd say
so. No, we're getting the message.
Gary, you were saying?
Well, I would say that... you know what they're revealing is the campaign of disinformation and truth embargo that we're discussing. In doing what they're doing and showing us that just a few people who can stand up and say yeah we make those on the way home from the pub for a laugh and convincing everybody, it kind of informs other activities because we're lied to on so many fronts through politics and through other instances. And so what it shows us, it reflects back to us that we're all kind of sleepwalking in a way and not looking at facts and not looking at the evidence that's very clear, and we're being duped. And so I think the message, once you listen to the message and you block out the nonsense that these people are claiming that they run out and make them with boards and rope, it's very, very clear and it's very, very loud what they're saying.
Okay.
But when you're not listening to it that way and you're listening to the hype about people just doing it for a joke to trick us all, then it's not so clear. So
Howard, let me jump in here. Darcy speaking. Yep. So a message that is pretty clear that we've had in history that showed up in one of these crop formations happened in 2000, the year 2000. It was a very complex sort of circle array. It was a bunch of larger circles, three connected, and then on the outer two circles were hundreds of smaller circles permeating outwards. Beautiful glyph, and this is, you can look it up, you can Google it, it's called the Chilbolton Crop Circle of 2000. Now, we didn't really have a reference for what this was until 2001. In 2001, we got a more complex message that was laid out in one of these crops in the same location, the Chilbolton crop location in the UK. And this formation showed up right beside a dish, radio telescope that is being employed right on the perimeter of this crop in the UK. That radio telescope sends signals out into space and receives. And the message that was found in 2000 became clear in 2001 because the second glyph that showed up was a answer to the Arecibo Space Observatory message that was sent out by Carl Sagan in 1974. And this is incredible. People still debate it. When Carl Sagan heard about crop circles,
it was very interesting that he completely dismissed them, just like a lot of the UFO information or the anomalies that have happened in space regarding UFOs throughout history. But I digress. The Arecibo Observatory, that's located in Puerto Rico and run by, you know, the U.S., the National Science Foundation, it's really defunct now. It fell apart. It's been damaged.
2 months ago, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, and not too long ago. And this was used to send out some of the most important information into space. And we're constantly spamming space with our radio signals from, you know, our massive media empires and so on and so forth. But this, in 1974, sent out a 10-point radio communication to our cosmos, to our neighbors in the cosmos, you know, and it, three things that it said near the end of the message was our DNA profile, the planet that we exist on, which is the third rock from the sun, Earth, and also our human form. And okay, a fourth point, the very last one, was the type of technology that was used to send out this message, which showed a diagram of a radio telescope. Okay, like the Arecibo. Mm-hmm. And if you look up the Chilbolton crop circle from 2001, this shows a point for point rectangular breakdown answering our 10-point message that was sent out. And it quite literally says, we're here. This is the planet we live in, which we have all kinds of information we can dissect there. It talks about their DNA structure. It shows their bodily form. And it was accompanied by a face. And it just, no humans have come forward to lay claim to making this or hoaxing this.
And look, it was audacious or clever or whatever you want to call it to cite that reply, if you say it's a reply, adjacent to a communications device. The only question I would have is, why would they wait so long?
I think it might be not a case of, so when people say, okay, why would a extraterrestrial race not just land their craft on the White House lawn? Why are they putting crop glyphs or designs down? Well, if we think about it this way, if we think about our galaxy, our universe that's full of galaxies, and the possibilities of who could be trying to interface with us, I'm sure there are some that are coming here with craft, have tried to land. Some have successfully landed. You know, there's many, many documented events where there have been landings. Westall 66, the Areola School in South Africa, you know, going on and on. But if you're thinking about a race that may have received one of our signals, like the Arecibo communication, and they're too far away and they can't possibly travel the distance with their technology yet to actually physically interface with us, perhaps whatever technology, whatever probe or exotic high science that they're using to lay these crop circles remotely, you know, send something else that can do this, is their best way of communicating with us. So that's one way of looking at it.
So you've got to cut them a bit of slack here, because if you think the difficulties and technical challenges that we are having right now, mastering the atmosphere, the terrain of Mars, because it's so far away and so different, then, you know, you've got to cut them some slack. Maybe that's difficult for them. Okay, we've gone into the crop circles a little more than I wanted to at this stage, but that's okay, because it's interesting and this is stuff that is certainly new to me. Underground bases. And the reason we're talking to these three guys, by the way, is they are all connected, and they're connected through Darcy Weir, because he's worked with them all together on collaborative projects that we'll talk about in the summation to this at the end, so you can see those collaborative projects. The underground bases story is fascinating because it is not, it's not the most popular topic in all of ufology, is it? Maybe, Steve, I can give you this, because I know you have an interest in these underground bases. It's not the number one topic of discussion, is it, in ufology? But it is there, and it is increasingly being discussed, yeah?
Certainly, there are many aspects to the extraterrestrial phenomena history and exopolitics and so forth, and some of them are more interesting than others. Underground bases, again, my interest there is exopolitical. As I mentioned before, one of the tools of the truth embargo is to just make you prove everything over and over again, thus you don't come to any outcome and the government gets off. Underground bases are another key tool to the truth embargo, because so much of the engagement of the issue by the government is, almost all of it has to be massively classified. There's work to be done, re-engineering, all kinds of stuff. So underground is the way to go. You simply don't do this above ground if you can absolutely avoid it. Now, we all know, underground facilities have been built by major empires and so forth going back thousands of years, some of them unbelievably complex. It's extraordinary. I watch Ancient Aliens, I'm sorry. And and then we know the Nazis went crazy underground. So what about now? Hell, the technology that the United States has had in the last 60 years to go underground compared to what the Nazis had is not even comparable. We have the ability to build whole cities down there. Have we gone that far? Don't know. Have we built lots of facilities? You bet. They're all over the West.
So what do you think we've got, the stuff that you know about? What sorts of things are there?
If you've got ET bodies, eventually they go underground. If you're doing re-engineering on any kind of ET tech, you go underground. In fact, any aspect that can be put underground, you do it, because it just absolutely maximizes the ability to keep this under wraps. And now, but that's not the only thing. I mean, we've taken a lot of things underground in this country because we've classified everything. Anything and everything is classified in the basis of national security. So one of the reforms that are going to be needed once the truth embargo ends and people finally realize that big lie is over, is we've got to reform the military intelligence complex whole classification reality. And the underground facilities have got to be completely vetted, meaning independent commissions have got to be able to examine everything and determine what is appropriate to remain that way and what needs to be brought out.
Well, they've got to admit to them first.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're right. They admitted to Area 51 eventually. I don't know if the government's ever admitted to underground facilities, except, of course, that they have known facilities like that. Mount Weather and elsewhere, everybody knows that we have things inside of mountains. All right. But beyond that, no, they're not saying anything. And that's got to be reformed. It's just one of many things that has to be dealt with once we get past disclosure and try to sort out all of the craziness that has developed since the end of World War II in the last 75 years during the Cold War and the nuclear standoff and all of that. It's a distorted thing. It's costing a fortune. It's undermining trust in government. So that's just on the list of reforms. It's a long list.
What do you think is underneath Antarctica?
Well, Antarctica, first of all, it's not just us. There's every likelihood that the extraterrestrials are operating from bases. They could be operating off-planet. They could be having facilities off-planet, moon, pick any moon of the solar system, whatever. But most likely, and there's some evidence for this, they operate from bases. There are a lot of craft flying around. It's when you see something in the sky, everybody's not seeing the same one. So there's a lot of craft. And we believe they operate from their own underground facilities or under mountain facilities or under the ocean facilities where we simply can't get to them. And Antarctic would obviously be a very easy location to have a base. Prior to World War II, my Lord, who went down there? I mean, it was just absolutely remote. And then the Nazis head on down there, leading up to World War II and perhaps during, which probably created a bit of a fuss. And then we sent an entire fleet down there. So we might have disturbed a hornet's nest, but it would not shock me at all if the ETs at some time or another, and may still do, have bases in the Antarctic.
So do you think there's a sort of nexus of cooperation, if that's the right word, probably isn't, between ourselves and the ETs, and all of this is going on underground?
No. I'm saying that we have underground facilities.
And they do.
They probably operate from, quote, underground facilities. But whether we're cooperating with them, that has not been proven. And so I don't assert that.
Okay. But the takeaway point is, if you want to keep a thing secret, we know that you stick it underground. If you want to bury $1 million that you've got in gold doubloons, then you dig it into the garden. All right. This is where Phil Schneider comes into this conversation. And again, I didn't know much about him and his story. And Steve, I think you and I have touched on this on an on-air conversation within recent months. Anyway, this guy, if you're going to be building underground facilities, then you need a geologist. And that's what Phil Schneider was, yeah?
Yeah, the Phil Schneider case for me, again, I'm not a researcher. I'm aware of it. It's a complicated case, goes back a long ways. Phil was a complicated guy, troubled, lots of issues. And so for me, he's more of a symbol. In other words, and he's not the only one that I could cite in this regard. When the government institutes secrecy of this kind, not just secrecy, but massive disinformation, lying, and so forth, then the citizens try to fill in the blanks. Right. Or the citizens engaged the issue in some form or fashion. But it's all dysfunctional. It's not functional. It's not good. And so there's all the mystery, conspiracies, all kinds of assertions, lots of background noise, and people get drawn into it. And we've seen this over and over again. And it's like going down the rabbit hole. And in a lot of cases, they never come back out. I know of several cases personally that are not particularly well known. But and this is they are somewhat victims of the government's policy of systemic lying. There's all kinds of, and by the way, if you want to describe what the hell is happening in the United States right now, going back, you could go back 30 years, but certainly going back the last 4 to 10 years, that's continuing to escalate. This is the predictable outcome of institutional lying. The United States government kind of went off the road, make everything classified, deny everything you need to deny, hide, obfuscate, lie. And you do that long enough, you literally undermine the fundamental trust of the citizenry in government. This is a complex country with a lot of free people, a lot of freedoms. So you do that and you create chaos. And so institutional lying turns up all throughout the issue of the extraterrestrial presence.
Okay. Darcy Weir, what the collaborative project that we're sort of getting into here with the discussion of underground bases is Phil Schneider, isn't it? And I know that Steve says he's part of a tapestry of secrecy, of lies, of mis and disinformation. From what I understand of this man's story, and it's not one that I've researched in depth, so I want to know more about this. As a filmmaker, I'm sure you were attracted to this because it's a fascinating and sad story to tell. This man was involved in underground constructions on a geological basis, because that was his expertise, but he was found dead. And that, of course, sparks an entire mystery to evolve around him. Yeah?
Yes, that's right. Phil Schneider really kind of rose in popularity in the 90s. And we all know about UFO and Bigfoot and exopolitical conferences that have been happening throughout the ages. He really was becoming a hero to people to speak at these conferences back in 1992, 1993, 94, died in 96. And what's really remarkable about him is that he rallied people behind this story. The story that he had been in a battle with aliens underground when he was contracted to do the geology work of helping blast out and tunnel out with boring machines for the American military and these third-party military industrial complex corporations, you know, like Bechtel or Morrison Knudsen. in building an underground base in the Dulce, New Mexico area. Part of the Dulce, New Mexico Mesa Ridge formation. And I think Historia's complex, like Stephen Bassett had mentioned, the really interesting thing about him is that not everything he said was true. Some of it might have struck a chord. He may have been killed. He may have been suicided, so to speak. Many people speculate that. And I interviewed his ex-wife. I interviewed Richard Dolan in this documentary and Richard Souter. Richard Souter has written 4 different books on the evidence and history of military-industrial complex involvement with patenting certain technologies and having plans to build underground bases all around the world, you know, under the oceans. And he even shows in his book, Hidden in Plain Sight, a schematic or a illustration that was made by a British man to build underground, underwater bases for the British Navy. So people should definitely check out that book. You can see the illustrations in there. But I digress. So Phil Schneider, he, to me, the most credible stuff about him was the information that he took and lectured about on tour. And he showed photographs, which he inherited from his father. Now, his father was a... he worked for the Nazi Navy during World War II, was brought over under Project Paperclip to the United States through Project Paperclip, which was a program of hiring assets, hiring high intelligence researchers that were from the German military and the multiple factions that were there researching certain technologies that could empower the United States military. And when Oscar, his father's name is Oscar Otto Schneider, was brought over, he worked on projects like the USS Nautilus, which is a nuclear submarine, the United States' first nuclear submarine. And he also worked on the bomb tests that they were doing, the nuclear bomb testing.
Here is a man who would have been on a lot of need-to-know lists.
Yeah, exactly. Black projects. And I think this really empowered Phil with knowledge and got him into the right sort of groups that he would then possibly get contracted and get work to work on some of these black projects, like for Morrison Knudsen. In the documentary, Cynthia Dreyer, who was formerly known as Cynthia Schneider, his ex-wife, had actually been fighting to get medical benefits for Phil Schneider. He was disabled, very wounded near the end of his life. One of those benefits that he was getting from the government was a pension that came from his social security number that he worked under for Morrison Knudsen, you know, and this is around the time in the 70s that he stated he was working for them building these underground bases. So he could have actually been doing that type of work. The part of the story that falls apart for me that I think was fabricated and used to really create sensationalism and draw people to him was the alien firefight story. I think that was kind of a byproduct of the imagination and the media that was blowing up heroism in the 90s and the late 80s. You know, you got Rambo, James Bond, all these sort of action stars that are coming to the scene, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and they're
right.
battling so hordes of bad guys.
Cut to the chase, then. You think that it's more urban or maybe suburban mythology. And a firefight at the Dulce base never actually happened.
I don't think so. I think that there's perfect evidence to provide that there's something going on under the Dulce, New Mexico Ridge, like, the Paul Benowitz story, who came out in 1990, where he spoke of intercepting signals from some kind of communications coming underground there. He stated that there was probably an extraterrestrial base there before Phil Schneider even started discussing this. And Paul Benowitz, as many people may or may not know, he ended up getting very disinformed by a insider, Richard Doty. He was handed all kinds of documents. His personal life fell apart. He became obsessed with UFOs and all this type of information. His business fell apart. He eventually committed suicide. So we have definitely Richard Doty to thank for that disinformation from the United States Air Force, who he was contracted to work for, to infiltrate UFO communities and spread lies.
All right. But back to Phil Schneider. Why was he speaking about these things? You said he became quite celebrated on the, you know, the conference circuit. He was giving lectures almost on this stuff. Now, if this was secret work and he was on need-to-know lists, why was he doing that?
Yeah, so his father passed away, and he was working on a kind of like a little newspaper digest called the Alien Digest with his best friend, Ron Rummel, who is a retired Air Force personnel who said he had a lot of information about UFOs from his inside contacts at the United States Air Force. And he knew about the early space war program and its what Ronald Reagan and the military industrial complex was planning to do with the Star Wars program. And Ron Rummel ended up passing away. It looked like a suicide, but there's things about his death that seemed really interesting that didn't seem very usual, let's say, in a suicide case. So, for example, he suffered from a gunshot to the head, point blank, and the gun was completely clean. There was no blowback of blood on his arm, on his hand, nothing. And he was found in a park in Portland, Oregon. Phil Schneider really kind of was aggravated by this death, and he went on national television and said, my friend was suicided, and he knew information, and we were working on releasing information relating to this underground military industrial complex program researching UFOs in space and taking millions and billions of dollars of public funding to research black projects and underground base information. And I'm going to talk about it. So that's really when he started to go on lecture tour. And eventually he was found dead in his own apartment, a motel apartment that he was renting in Portland. And the investigation sort of was open shut case at first until they found his own catheter cord wrapped around his neck and his face down, and his own wheelchair was what was reported in the crime scene information. His wife, ex-wife, who was still his best friend, Cynthia Dreher, had asked the funeral director who had found that when he was starting to get the body ready to report this to the police, and she reported it to the police. The Clackamas County detectives started looking into it. They got an autopsy done. His wife requested blood, and she's a nurse. She requested blood and urine samples. She wanted to know what exactly was going on with him because she thought he had everything to live for. They had a daughter together. He was starting to become pretty popular. He was being asked to speak a lot. You know, if you just take his story and how popular he is now, you know, you can equate that to what was going on in his life at that time. He was starting to become a bit famous, and you know, his family members said he wanted to be around, but he was suspicious something was going to happen to him. Anthony Sanchez wrote a book, which is an interview he conducted with a former military colonel, allegedly, who worked at Los Alamos National Laboratory and was a director of apparently the Dulles, New Mexico research facility. And this colonel says in the book, UFO Highway, that he had handed documents to Phil a month before he had died, a big information package that had multiple points of reference to prove his case of the Dulles, New Mexico base unequivocally existing to the public. You know, because what he was saying was crazy. People were blown away by what he was saying. But this was supposed to be an information package to prove a lot of his points. And, you know, you look at what other researchers have done there. I've mentioned this before, but Norio Hayakawa, who's a Japanese researcher that led a Japanese news team down to Dulles, New Mexico, and the people that live there, that have lived there for hundreds of years, the Hikaraya, you know, the indigenous people of this area, have been mentioning UFOs, strange entities, you know, ant people, that type of thing, that are not human, that have been kind of haunting the Dulles, New Mexico Ridge for hundreds, maybe thousands of years, since people have been starting to build that town, build that city around this mesa area. And other people have, news crews from across the United States, independent researchers like myself, have traveled out to Dulles, New Mexico, have gone onto the ridge, and people report that they've found shafts that go down into the mesa that have all kinds of sounds and exhausts and such emanating out from the ridge, and there seem to be secret passageways and doorways to get in.
So to cut to the chase, Phil Schneider was at the apex of this thing. He was causing unnecessary, some may see it, or undue attention to be drawn to these matters. And the speculation might be that he became one of the people who was suicided in all of this.
It's very possible that that's the case. I believe it to be. You know, people mention William Cooper. He wrote Beyond the Pale Horse. He worked for the United States Navy. He was a very staunch advocate for disclosure in a certain way, in his own way. Kind of like a Alex Jones before Alex Jones. And very aggressive in his opinions about the United States disinformation tactics. And there's actually a really interesting, he had his own radio show, you know, just like you. But back in 2001, he died. And many people equate this with different stories. Some people say he was suicided, that there was a created, orchestrated situation where he would get aggressive with a gun and the police would take his life on his own doorstep. He was shot to death on his own doorstep. But other versions of this story are complex. And one that I find very interesting is there's a radio broadcast that he did a few months before he passed away, where he literally stated that the United States military was going to orchestrate a massive on American soil attack in 2001 that would blame Osama bin Laden for orchestrating this attack. And Osama bin Laden was a former CIA trained agent. And he said, don't let anybody pull the wool over your eyes on this situation. This is going to be a false flag. And he died 3 months after that radio broadcast. And we all know what happened on September 11th.
So I think this is inherently work about Phil Schneider, and I'm sorry to kind of dive in here.
You're
saying that there is almost a state behind the state that is constantly watching. And if you get out of line and you say too much about these matters, then you run a risk. Is that the central theme here? Other than the theme, of course, of getting justice for Phil Schneider.
I'd say so. I think the thing that dilutes or hurts the credibility of Phil is the alien firefight story. But he was creating a lot of attention and buzz about something that possibly the military industrial complex did not want a lot of buzz about, just like William Cooper.
Steve Bassett, do you worry that people who get too close to what may be the truth in all of this put themselves at some degree of risk?
Worry? No. I didn't enter the field until 96. Very, very few people were, I believe, throughout the truth embargo, very few people were mortally impacted. I'm not saying there weren't some, but it wasn't many, very few. Because the government really had it under control in a lot of ways. Let me make two quick exopolitical points about what was just said. One, you hear all the time about people falling down the rabbit hole. It's a nice phrase. It's really in play right now because there's just so much of it. I get it. What people need to keep in mind is for the last 75 years, the government has been busy building rabbit holes for us to fall down. And the second point is, if Phil Schneider had the goods back in early 90s, and he really had documents from his father, whatever, that showed these kinds of programs, hard documents. And he had taken those to the New York Times, just walked right in and turned them over to the New York Times. And New York Times would not have covered that. They would have not have done that story. A quarter of a century later, some other people walked in some truly extraordinary things to the New York Times, and they put two huge articles on the front page of the New York Times about those stories. And so that, to me, represented about as well as anything the progress that's been made in the last 25 years.
So you and I have talked about the excitement that abounds at the moment, that there may be hearings, there may well be imminent further disclosures. Essentially, Steve, what we're saying is, and I think we know this, we are living in radically different times. Now, why this is all coming to a head now, that's another issue.
Well, I can tell you part of the reason why. Huge numbers of people, documentarists, citizen researchers, citizen journalists, have and witnesses and contactees, thousands of them, have come forward, have produced content, pressed the government in every way they could with the very limited resources that they have. Occasionally, there was some help from some higher, stronger resources, such as Lawrence Rockefeller. He definitely contributed in the early days. Unfortunately, he passed before he could probably really put some major money into it. And Robert Bigelow and a few others. But overall, it's been a citizen science research journalist effort up against the most powerful nation in the world with unbelievable amounts of money and resources, massive security systems. And those people have pushed this issue to the point where at least now the major journalism is finally said, okay, we're going to get into this more than just cover it. We're going to dig a little bit. We're going to get on the disclosure train. The academic world is still pretty much stayed out. They have decided to pretty much keep their heads stuck straight into the bog pit until the last dog dies. There have been a couple that have come forward, but overall, and I've said it countless times, the greatest intellectual failure in history. What the Catholic Church did with the early discoveries about the solar system is nothing compared to the failure of the academic world on this issue over the last 70 years. So that's why it's changed, okay? And so, and I think once disclosure does happen, I think the world, because of the internet particularly, this massive record of everything, will step forward and acknowledge this unbelievable work by the citizens of many countries, America, UK, Canada, Spain. I mean, hell, I've been all over the world. There's people that have been pushing this, trying to get this issue resolved. And it's one of the greatest accomplishments of the citizenry of nations in the history of man.
But the conditions had to be right. And I think what you're saying is we're looking at also a sociological phenomenon here. This is an era where people are attaining or trying to attain their rights when they're calling out injustice. The breed of politician maybe that we have around now and the breed of decision maker is different. And when you get an opening like that, then maybe the truth comes out.
That's worse. No. The quality of the politicians have declined.
Well, I'm not talking about their intellectual ability, but I'm talking about their willingness to embrace freedoms.
I don't give them that kind of credit. They are... this issue is being driven by a citizen science research movement against the counterforces coming.
I understand. So it's not them opening up; it's them having to get out the way.
We created the conditions that make this possible. We created them, and now those that are in the areas of responsibility are acceding to those new conditions.
Right. So the pressure, just like, in the 1960s with the race situation in the United States, the pressure becomes such that change has to happen.
Absolutely. That's a perfect analogy. Not long, very shortly before the Civil Rights Acts, the two key ones, were passed in the United States, George Wallace, who got 30% in that presidential campaign, went in front of the people of Alabama and said, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever. And then it was ended by law. And so why do I get emphatic here? Hey, look, I love what the New York Times has done. I love what the people inside the Pentagon are doing by getting the TTSA out there. I love all that's going on. These are wonderful things. All right. But I'm going to do my best to make sure that what people learn now, the historians will figure it out, but what people learn in the now is what happened, all right? And what happened is the people around the world, heavy emphasis in the United States, went after this issue with absolute determination, sacrificing money and time and gave whatever they could to it. And they did it while being ridiculed, undermined, attacked, libeled, and they've succeeded. And I want to make sure that the people understand this thing finally comes to a close. All power to the Times, all power to President Biden, who will be the disclosure president, hopefully. But don't forget, without the massive citizen science effort, we would still be down the rabbit hole chasing shadows.
See what happens in the rest of this year. Darcy Weir, among your recent work, your collaborative efforts, you are very proud, rightly, of getting the last interview with a wonderful man who I had the pleasure of meeting just the once in London, but having spoken to many, many times, Stanton T. Friedman. Talk to me about that encounter that turned out to be his final interview.
Yeah, so we were actually building our first documentary with Stephen Bassett at the time, called Being Taken. Beyond the Spectrum, Being Taken. It's on Tubi TV. I think if people just go to tubitv.com, they can check out, search for Being Taken. And it's the definitive documentary on the history of the abduction phenomenon. So we cover, all the earliest reports of supposed entities taking humans and doing things with them throughout history.
And presumably you speak to a lot of the principals, Travis Walton, Calvin Parker, yes. Kathleen Marden, of course, the niece of Betty and Barney Hill.
Yeah, we spoke to Travis Walton, Kathleen Marden, Stan Friedman, because he actually was very involved in deciphering whether this abduction phenomenon was real. This was a nuclear physicist by trade that started researching the Roswell, New Mexico crash in the 70s. And he since then had been convinced that the government was covering something up. And he dived into the multiple layers of the onion that this subject unveils. And what I found very interesting with him in interviewing him, one of my favorite things that I had uncovered was his battle with skeptics. His battle in the public forum on CNN and Dateline and, you know, Larry King Live, every sort of Fox TV, he was out there being a proponent for disclosure and ending the truth embargo.
Doggedly, every time you spoke with him, charming, but doggedly determined. I never really spoke with him much about the abduction phenomenon, though. Did he believe that those things happened?
100%, yes. And Kathleen Martin is a relative of Betty and Barney Hill. So she's actually the niece of Betty. Betty and Barney Hill, people may not know that story, but that's the most prolific. That was the first time that a couple had ever said, we were taken on board a craft one night, and we've been taken multiple times by a group of extraterrestrials that wanted to examine us like specimens. And abduction really wasn't covered until their story hit the headlines in the 1960s. They were driving down a country road and they saw a light in the sky. They kind of slowed down their car. The light approached, their car deactivated, so to speak. They got out of the car. Barney grabbed a set of binoculars, honed in on this light, saw that there was a being looking at him from observing from the craft. He got psychic thoughts. He was frozen physically. So was Betty. They couldn't move. They were soon coaxed through telepathy and physically onto the craft. And that's really where everything started. Genetic material was taken, so on and so forth. Now, with your question to Stanton Friedman, he examined the really complex information that was coming out of their reverse hypnosis sessions that happened, which uncovered what happened to them following this abduction. And one of the things that Betty described was where the captors had said they were from. They were from a binary star system that is not too far from us and was found in this area of the sky. She could point it out. And she had a image projected to her of what the star constellation looked like around this. Now, Stan Friedman and another astrophysicist had examined, I can't remember her name, but they had examined this information that was brought out through this hypnosis. And she had done a 3D, astronomer had done a 3D calculation of where the star system was and what should be there. And when astronomy caught up to this information, later in, I think it was the 1980s, they found that this new star system was called Zeta Reticuli. And these beings describe themselves as coming from Zeta Reticuli. So astronomy literally caught up with an abduction phenomenon case.
So Stanton, although the hypnosis results have been controversial and people have challenged those, Stan Friedman bought into the whole thing. He believed that, you know, this really happened and that abductions of this kind are commonplace, fairly.
Yes, yes. And he stood behind the science that came out of that study, came out of their hypnosis sessions that could be confirmed. And he was a big proponent of looking at the facts. Mm. You know, he always wanted the facts about cases, and he had the best facts ever when it came to the cover-up by the military-industrial complex to disseminate disinformation, to tell lies to the public, and to cover up the UFO subject in history. So that was really interesting that we got to sit down with him and talk about that.
But when I did one of his last interviews when he retired, now you did the last interview. I did probably, 20 interviews before that. I don't know. But he retired and sadly died not very long after that. But, you know, I did an interview with him on his retirement. I said to him I would be very sad not to be able to speak with him quite so often in future. And he said, but, you know, the thing is, you know, don't I deserve a rest now? Which you can't deny that the guy had worked so hard on this for so many years. But absolutely, the point that he made to me, and I wonder if he made this point to you, was that he felt the case had been made. You know, what else can we say now? The science had said it, the research had said it, the witnesses had said it, case made. Anything beyond that, he felt, was just going round in circles. Did he make that point to you?
Yeah, he made it very clear that, you know, we're being visited. There's so much data. If people are interested slightly in this subject, if they go out there, they can find this data, the facts about certain incidents that have happened around the world. And he was fed up, you know, he was aggravated that it wasn't widely accepted by the public. But that is a reality that's as a result of our mass media and what is commonplace thought on our planet.
Well, I'm just very sad that he's not here now. Sorry again to dive in.
No problem.
Said this was going to be a complex conversation. I've got three of you and a limited amount of time, but you know, we're making it happen. Okay. I want to get back to Gary in Mexico. Gary, you're not done. Sorry I haven't come to you in the last 30 minutes or so. I want to go back to the crop circles, if I may, you know, sort of winding it all around. And you three, if my listener's wondering why we're all speaking together, you're all connected by Darcy because you've worked on collaborative projects with him. And we will name those projects at the back end of this so people can see them. So, Gary, if you are still there, why do you think we're not messaging back? If we understand the methodology of some of these crop circles, why don't we message them back in the same way?
That's a question that's often asked. You know, and Darcy mentioned earlier that we sent a message out and we got a reply, and look at the reaction.
But, you know, why haven't we started a dialogue?
Well, at the moment, you said earlier, why don't they just send a clear message, which I assume you meant in the English alphabet, which says, you know, get your act together and put that in the English alphabet in a field. Well, I think probably people wouldn't take that. They would take that even less seriously than they take a highly complex geometric construction. And so they're communicating to us in the language of form, in the language of number, which is a very mysterious thing. Number itself is, it existed before we came up with it. Humans came up with the concept of number, and we developed these symbols that represent ones and twos and threes and so on. But when we look around in nature, we find number is everywhere, and it's always been here. Five-petaled flowers, you know, we're born with five teeth, which fall out and are replaced by eight teeth. 5, 8, and 13 are part of the Fibonacci sequence and so on. And so the construction, the theory that goes back to the ancient Greeks onwards, is that the universe is constructed using number. And geometry is an expression of number. It's number in space. A triangle is 3, a square is 4, and so on. And there are people such as Carl Jung and Marie-Louise von Franz who believe that our consciousness is actually the primary archetype of our consciousness is number.
Okay. But if we know all this, then why aren't we using those? And in fact, when we've sent messages into space on probes and what have you, we have used mathematics because it is the most basic universal form of communication. Why aren't we extrapolating from what we know and laying out messages in Hyde Park?
Well, Here's this goes to what you've just been talking about. Whitley Strieber wrote a book with a man called Jeffrey Krippow some years ago, and the Jeffrey Krippow is a historian of mysticism, and he's done exhaustive research on people who have mystical experiences, and then what subsequently follows with the society's or public's reaction to these people. And at the end of the book, Whitley Strieber has a fantastic quote which says that the truth of what is happening to us all right now with regards to UFOs, crop circles, and other mystical phenomena won't come to light with evidence, with facts, because we've demonstrated that there's enough facts for us to accept it. So there's a resistance on our part, and that resistance is because we don't fully face the truth of many things. There is an aspect of willful blindness that we all engage in, not just to facts that are put in front of us in the world, but indeed interpersonally with our own blindness towards ourselves.
Right, so we're not interested in communicating back.
Well, I would say in a nutshell, we haven't reached a level where we're honest enough to ourselves and to each other where we can have an open dialogue with these beings that know only truth and know only facts.
So
I believe they're encouraging us to.
And again, I'm sorry to dive in. It's just because the clock is always against me on these things. It sounds to me then, and I've never asked a crop circle researcher, and I should have, we need a campaign to explain to people what this is all about, not just to do it in occasional gee whiz articles in newspapers. You know, we're into the spring-summer crop circle season here in the UK now. There are bound to be reports very soon, I'm sure, if there haven't been already. And we need some kind of systematic, not too heavy scientific, campaign of explanation, don't we?
Yes, I believe that the public deserve to know a lot of facts which are kept out of the media, and those are facts which I've come across over my 25 years of research. Most people get a couple of, you know, they see a couple of newspaper articles by the Daily Mail and so on, you know, oh, here's some lovely crop circles and here's the guys who make them. Some people believe they're a mystery, ha, ha, ha. And that's done across the board, whereas the details which show that, as we mentioned earlier, that these are impossible to make in the time frame and the conditions. And not only that, the communication, what forms part of the communication, is actually very deep, and it's about us. It's about humanity. Mm. People need to know this, definitely.
Well, what are you going to be doing to make sure they do?
Well, I'm doing the best I can. I've written a 16-episode documentary for Gaia. I've just done a two-hour special, which is going to be released on History Channel next week. I'm doing an interview with Whitley Strieber on the 14th. I'm partway through my book.
So I think we can say you're definitely playing your part in it all. I mean, look, I find crop circles fascinating. And on the balance of probabilities, how can they possibly? I've never believed that they could be all the work of people. Of course they're not. Until somebody convinces me otherwise, then, you know, it's just ridiculous to assume that it's people.
I would say to you that, you know, we talked about Carl Sagan earlier, and he came up with this wonderful phrase which said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Indeed.
Now, I've said for very many years that I only require ordinary evidence to prove that these people who claim they make the crop circles actually do it. And that is for them to go out in the fields under the same conditions under which we know they appear, which is in 4 or 5 hours of darkness in British summertime, in the dark, and make a highly complex geometric construction without damaging the crop. They have never been able to do that. They've only ever done these little demonstrations where they make a very small crop circle in the daylight on TV. It takes them upwards of, you know, 24 hours to a week to make them. And when we look at the crop on the floor, it's very, very damaged. So, you know, I just need ordinary evidence to substantiate these claims that these people make all the crop circles, and they've never provided it.
And we're still looking. Gary, thank you for that. I think I'm going to have to more or less wrap it up fairly soon, Darcy.
I'll just add quickly to what Stephen and Gary King were echoing on this phenomenon of crop circles, is that, look, people have been given the conditions that most of these really anomalous crop circles have shown up, which is in the cover of night, you know, pitch dark at 3 o'clock, 2:30 in the morning, with no signs of human interaction in the field, no lights to be seen being employed to use them, or technology to, you know, lay them out in such a mathematical precision on a hill, you know, not just a flat surface, which many crop circles that are man-made show up on, without damaging the crop. And the crop also seems to still thrive and grow after these formations are laid out. Sometimes there's even been UFO sightings. And in my documentary, we show an event that Gary King was involved in, which is called 777, where there was a strange flash of light in the middle of the night. And when the sun came up, there was this massive 1,033-foot intricate crop circle design. But there was also, in 1996, a video that's been around the internet, and we broke down quite immensely in this doc, which was recorded by an Australian gentleman that had traveled all the way to the UK in the 90s to see if he could record a crop circle formation. But he captured UFOs on camera, these orbs of light that were floating around this area called, I believe it's called the Oliver Castle, mm-hmm. is the area. And when he recorded these orbs, he didn't see it on his little mini DV cam at the time. But when he went to a pub 4 hours later and showed people there, they could see in the dark that this formation was actually being laid out as these orbs were floating over top of the crop.
Suggesting something energetic was at work.
Yes. And the conditions that constantly boggle the minds of scientists that have approached this research, like William C. Levengood, a man from Michigan, that saw signs of electromagnetic energy that was exposing these crops. He said plasma. And Gary can go into that even more. But the interesting thing is that none of these men in slacks, we've kind of coined this funny name, you know, not men in black, but men in slacks, Doug Bauer and Dave Chorley famously came out in 1991 saying, "We created all the crop circles that have appeared in the countryside of the UK since the 1970s. We did it." And people said, "Okay, well, how did you do it?" Well, with a board and rope. And they watched how they did it. They damage the crop. They destroy it. And they're definitely not nearly as intricate as what we've seen.
They are just not the same. Okay, we are going to have to wrap things up, unfortunately. I think we've achieved a remarkable thing here because we've covered a lot of disparate ground. And as I say, Darcy, you are the rallying point in all of this because you guys have worked collaboratively. So we've sort of talked about themes in three different projects that you've been involved in. The latest one is about crop circles. What's the title of that?
Crop Circle Realities.
Yeah. And that's due out soon, isn't it?
It just came out March 13th.
All right. So it's only been
just
a couple of weeks.
Just under a month. All right. Yeah.
The other one is about the guy who worked on the underground bases. Phil Schneider. Yep, Phil. What's that called?
Yep. It's called The Underground.
Okay.
Just called The Underground, yeah. And you can find that on Amazon Prime, Tubi TV, iTunes, Google Play, these type of streaming places. Many of my films can be found in these same locations. If people just check it out, they can go to my website, which is www.occultjourneys.com. I have the trailers there, the posters. If they click on the poster, it goes through to a site that they can stream these.
All right. And of course, the third documentary is about abductions.
Yeah, being taken. With Travis Walton, Stephen Bassett, you know, all these abductees, and the history of the phenomenon. So just kind of defining it and making sure people know it can't be all equated with some kind of mass hysteria or psychological disorders. These are real events that have happened in history.
Darcy, thank you for that. Steve, if you are still listening in Washington, which is still there, thank you very much, Steve. Nice to speak with you again. And we will catch up on the radio quite soon about progress in ongoing matters, which we've been discussing a lot lately. And Gary, thank you very much indeed. I'd love to speak with you a lot more about crop circles separately, maybe on my radio show. And we can also talk about your work with Jaime Mosai, if you'd like to.
Absolutely, indeed. Yeah, it'd be a pleasure.
Thank you very much, all three of you. You are the Bee Gees, or the three tenors, I think, of this of this particular genre. So I think it was amazing to get you all together. And thank you very much, all of you. Gary, Steve, and Darcy, have a great day. Take care.
You too. Thanks, Howard. Cheers.
Well, that was quite a conversation and a bit of a technological first for me, certainly, here on The Unexplained. Your thoughts, of course, as ever, welcome on that. Gary King, Darcy Weir, Steve Bassett. What a combination of talent all together in the same place at the same time, talking about interesting stuff, which is what, I hope, The Unexplained is all about. We have more great guests in the pipeline here at The Unexplained as we head into spring and then into some kind of summer here in the United Kingdom. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online. And please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. And if you can, please go to the website, theunexplained.tv, and leave a donation for the show if that's possible. If it isn't possible, that's perfectly okay. But if you possibly can, then it will be gratefully received. And if you've done that recently, thank you very, very much indeed. Till the next time, take care. Bye-bye.